Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to finish off the book of Ecclesiastes by covering the last chapter, chapter 12, which I will call Remember Your Creator in Your Youth. Solomon begins now in Ecclesiastes 12, verses 1 through 4. So remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of adversity come, and the years approach when you will say, I have no delight in them, before the sun and the light are darkened, and the moon and the stars and the clouds return after the rain, on the day when the guardians of the house tremble and the strong men stoop, the women who grind cease because they are few, and the ones who watch through the windows see dimly. The doors at the street are shut while the sound of the mill fades, when one rises at the sound of a bird and all the daughters of song grow faint. Now these four verses are very difficult. There are two streams of interpretation adopted by the commentators. I'll just give you a heads up before we start. One group of commentators says that the house being referred to here and all the other metaphors refer to the old man's body as he is about to die. The other group of commentators, a minority, unfortunately, because I'm in the minority, say that it's a literal house being referred to here, not the old man's body. Well, let's get into the weeds. Verse 1, Solomon says, so remember your Creator in the days of your youth before the days of adversity come. Why do you remember your Creator when you're young? So that you may be saved from the corruption and misery into which young people in general run. That could be what Solomon's saying, but I think more probably what he's saying is youth is an easier time to serve God because he's going to start talking about how horrible it is to be an old man like he is at the time of the writing of the book. And so he's saying, while you're young, take advantage of your youth and serve God. Remember God. Before the days of adversity come, that would be old age because of the affliction and trouble and the diseases, that age which we ironically call the golden years. I remember I was paying a bill at a urologist office, and the woman taking the bill was about my age. She was elderly, and she said something about the golden age. She says, oh yeah, the golden years, that's when everything falls apart. I never forgot that. And before the years approach when you will say, remember God, those years will approach when you will say, I have no delight in them. Why? Because your sight has been lost, your taste has been lost, your hearing has been lost, or at least it's declining. So you don't delight in life as you did before. Before the sun and the light are darkened, because the eyes in old age are dimmed, you don't see. And the moon and the stars and the clouds return after the rain. Well, the moon and the stars are darkened, and the clouds return after the rain, which means that there is a perpetual succession of evils, afflictions, and disorders in old age. As soon as one has gotten over, another follows. This is what John Gill says, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown interpret the verse in the same way. In verse 3, on the day when the guardians of the house tremble. Now, verse 3 is difficult. This is where all the controversy comes in. There's four groups of people mentioned in verse 3. I will read them. On the day when the guardians of the house tremble, the guardians or the watchmen. That's group number 1. Group number 2, the strong men stoop. So number 2 is strong men. Group number 3, the women who grind. They cease because there are few. So that's the third group, the women who grind. And the fourth group is the one who watch through the lattice, watch through the windows, seeing dimly. That's the fourth group. Well, let's see how we might interpret these metaphors or these words. On the day when the guardians of the house tremble. Here's some speculations. It's referring to the knees of the man. His house is his body, and the guardians of his body are his knees, or maybe his ribs, because his ribs protect him. Gill, Clark, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say it's the old man's arms and hands because they protect his body. If somebody attacks, they use their arms and their hands to ward off the attack. Some people say it's the head. Of course, it says guardians. Well, that would refer maybe to the eyes and the head. All of that I disagree with. I don't like that interpretation. As soon as I read it, I didn't like that interpretation. I'm so happy to find another commentator who agreed with me. This is Ellicott. He says that the guardians of the house are not a physical part of the old man's body, but the guardians of the house are servants who are trembling in distress as the master lies dying. Now, Ellicott uses this line of interpretation to refer to the other three groups in verse 3. The strong men in verse 3, the male servants in the household. That's not referring to a part of the old man's body, according to Ellicott. The grinding maids does not refer to the teeth of the old man. Ladies looking out of the lattice. All of these people are real people in the household, servants. And that's the interpretation I'm going to take. because I like it better. So, on the day when the guardians of the house, well, what's the house, as I've just said, it's either the body, as Gill and Benson say. As Ellicott says, expositors have generally understood the house here described as denoting the decaying body of the old man. And that's true. The majority of my commentators take the house to be the body. Here's some examples. Benson, Poole, Gill, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, the pulpit commentary, the Cambridge commentary. Ellicott disagrees. He says, I cannot but think that the house does denote the bodily frame, but I regard as unsuccessful the attempts which have been made to carry out this idea into its details. Well, Ellicott partly disagrees. He says the house is the body, but the rest of the groups that I mentioned in verse 3 are talking about servants, not members of the old man's body. I don't take it that way, though. I think the house is not the body. It's talking about the old man's house. Ellicott continues, or he says in a different place, but when it is attempted to carry out the figure and to find anatomical explanations of all the other images employed, the interpretation becomes so forced that some prefer to understand Ecclesiastes 12:3 is only a general description of the consternation produced by such a tempest as is spoken of in Ecclesiastes 12:2. The tempest in 12:2 was the clouds returning after the rain. And so some commentators say, well, this is just the consternation. Well, yes, that's the way I'm going to take it. Everybody running around as they anticipate the impending death of their master. Now, I did find another commentator, Colin Delitch, who say that the house is the literal house the man is dying in. And that's, as I said, that's the way I'm going to interpret it. Now let's look at the groups in verse 3. The guardians on the body interpretation. As I said, the guardians could be parts of the body, so the knees, the ribs, the head, the arms and the hands, whatever. If it's on the house interpretation, the guardians are merely watchmen who are looking out after the house, and they're trembling because they know their master's about to die. The second group says the strong men stoop. Well, if it's the strong men of the house, the servants of the house, they're stooping, they're bowed down in grief. And that's the way I take it. If, however, you say the house is the body of the old man, then the strong men of the old man could be his arms, his legs, or his thighs, his knees, and his feet. Legs or thighs are Gill, Clark, and Benson's idea. His knees and feet are Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's idea. And his back, according to Benson. Well, they're all over the place because I don't think that's what Solomon was referring to. Now, the third group in verse 3 are the women who grind. These women who grind cease because they are few. Well, if you take the women who grind as a member of the old man's body, that would be the old man's teeth, because teeth grind. They are few because they're falling out of the old man's head as he gets old. Now, some translations leave out the feminine part, the women who grind. As Ellicott points out, the Hebrew is grinding maidens, and in fact, my translation, the Holman Christian Study Bible, puts women in there, the women who grind. And that makes it hard for me to think that a man's teeth are being referred to. Why would you refer to your teeth as women who grind? I guess poetically you could. Well, if it's literal women who grind, why do they cease grinding? She's a servant who grinds at the mill, preparing food for the household. She stops grinding. But why would it say that the women who grind are a few? Kyle and Dillett say it's because many of the women who normally grind, they're too frightened to ply their task because of the upcoming death. And so they stop grinding. Makes sense to me. Now, the fourth group of servants, or body parts, that are mentioned in verse 3 are the ones who watch through the windows. They watch and see dimly. Well, if you take it as a servant who's watching and seeing dimly, it would be because the servants have no menial work to do. So they gaze idly from the lattices. So they look out and they don't really focus on anything. They're looking dimly, if you would. If you take it as being they're looking out dimly, as it were. But if you take the reference to those who look out the window as being a part of the old man's body, that would refer to his eyes. As the commentator Benson says, the eyes are looking out through the window of the eyes being the windows, and the servant is not seeing too well because his eyes are dim. We move down to verse 4. The doors at the street are shut. Well, now here is where it gets hard to refer the metaphors to the old man's body. It's just as easy to say the literal doors of a house are shut because of the impending death, as Ellicott says. All communication with the outer world has been broken off. Now, the pulpit commentary, which holds to a bodily interpretation of the house, says, quote, hitherto the symbolism has been comparatively easy to interpret. With this verse, inextricable difficulties seem to arise. Well, I don't like difficulties. The easiest way is usually the best way to interpret something. I think this is referring to literally the doors of a house. Those who say it's the bodily member of the old man, they disagree. John Gill says it's the mouth of the old man. Clark and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say it's the lips of the old man. Old men, when they eat, tightly shut their mouth, otherwise the food will drop out. The commentator Benson says it refers to the outward senses of the old man. No, it's talking about the doors of the house are shut because the old man's about to die. We don't want a lot of people coming in and out. It's a house of mourning. And because the doors are shut, that's why the sound of the mill fades. You can't hear anymore what's going on outside because the doors are shut. Of course, those who hold to a bodily interpretation say the mill is the teeth of the stomach. The teeth grinds the food. The stomach digests the food. That's sort of what a mill does. It grinds up food, turns it into something else, turns the grain into something else. The Cambridge commentary agrees with me on this, although they generally take a bodily interpretation. They say here that a literal mill outside can't be heard because the doors are shut, which is exactly what Solomon meant, I'm convinced. So the doors are shut. The sound of the mill fades when one rises at the sound of a bird. Now, what does that mean? The public commentary says this is a very difficult sentence and has been variously explained. Well, let's look at the options. Option number one, the least noise awakens an old person out of his sleep. This is the usual interpretation, according to the pulpit commentary. Quote, it is usually taken to mean that the old man sleeps lightly and awakes, for rises up may mean no more than that. He awakes at the chirrup of a bird. Chirrup, I like that, chirrup of a bird. So we would read the verse this way. The doors of the street are shut. The old man's dying. Nobody can hear the mills outside. And at this time, the old man is trying to sleep. A bird chirps. And he's wide awake in the middle of the night, or maybe in the wee hours of the morning. That's the easiest way to interpret that. Here's some other option. At the sound of the cock's crow, the old man rises early in the morning. Old men are glad to get up, because otherwise they'd be lying on their bed, tossing and turning with painful dreams after a sleepless night. No, I never heard of an old man that would love to get up at the cock's crow. That's possible, but I don't think so. Another option, option number three, the bird cries during the storm. Now that involves a different translation. The bird gives out a chirp when he rises, something like that. I don't think so. Pulpit commentary denies that. Pulpit commentary also denies that the chirp of this bird is a bird of ill omen raising its voice. So the idea would be that people in the house would hear this raven, raving, gently rapping, tapping, some evil-looking bird out there making a sound and everybody gets up in terror. Well, that's very poetic, but I don't think that's what it means either. Now, the public commentary has an interesting interpretation. They say that the pitch of the old man's voice rises to the pitch of the bird. So the verse would read, when the old man's voice rises to the sound of the bird's voice. Because old men's voice rise when they get old. Think of Walter Brennan. I don't think so. In this case, I like the majority view that the old man rises at the least noise because he can't sleep well, because old men don't sleep as deeply as they do when they're younger. I can testify to that. Verse 4, the last part of it. And all the daughters of song grow faint. Well, who are the daughters of song? Well, those who hold to the bodily interpretation of these verses say that the daughters of song are the organs of the old man which make music. His lips, his mouth, his teeth, his throat, his lungs. They grow faint because the old man is dying. Some people say it's not the organs which make the music, but it's the organs which hear the music, the ears. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say it's both, the organs that make the music and the organs that hear the music. I don't think so. I think this is just referring to singing women. Their voices are faint because the old man is dying. They don't want to disturb him, or maybe they're in mourning so they can't sing gaily and loudly anymore. Or it could be the old man has no desire to hear them anymore. So looking at it from the point of view of the dying old man, the women who sing songs in his household, their voices are growing faint because he's dying. Well, after those cheery four verses, let's move to verse 5 of Ecclesiastes 12. Furthermore, Solomon continues, men are afraid of a high place and of terrors on the road. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags himself along, and the caperberry is ineffective. for man goes to his eternal home while mourners go about in the street. Well, Solomon is still talking about the old man that's dying, but the rest of the verse is somewhat obscure. Furthermore, men are afraid of a high place. Old men are afraid of high places because they get dizzy. And also, their reflexes are slower. And if they stumble, it's harder to stop themselves from falling over the precipice. Old men are afraid of terrors on the road because they're weak. They can't fight off strong-armed robbers. The almond tree blossoms. Now, Ellicott says that this means that the almond is loathed because of the man's old age. He can't taste anymore, doesn't want to eat almonds anymore. But I think most of the commentaries say that the almond tree is a metaphor for the hoary head, the old man's head, which is white, just like an almond tree in blossom is white. So the almond tree blossoms means the old man's hair has gotten very white. I think that's the way to interpret that. Next, Solomon says the grasshopper drags himself along. The KJV has the grasshopper shall be a burden. Most of the translations have, though, the grasshopper drags himself along. Well, if that's referring to an old man, that's pretty obvious. An old man looks like a grasshopper dragging himself along, as Jameson Fawcett Brown say. His legs and his arms are emaciated, skinny like a grasshopper's legs, front and back. The old man's shoulders, his back, his lips, they're all crumpled up and bunching out, kind of like a grasshopper. If you take the KJV translation, which I don't, the grasshopper shall be a burden. That could mean that a very light grasshopper jumping on an old man will be a burden. He can't even carry a grasshopper anymore. Or it could be an old man, if he ate a tiny little grasshopper, even that would upset his stomach. But I don't believe that is the proper translation. I think this is a great metaphor. The grasshopper dragging himself along, just like an old man in the street. Now, one of my commentators, and I have lost the sight, says that this grasshopper dragging itself along is a penis, representing the fact that the old man has lost the desire for sex. Well, that's very creative, but I don't think that's what it means. Although the next phrase in verse 5 might make one think so. The caperberry is ineffective, and you say, what does the caperberry have to do with a limp penis? Well, the KJV and the NIV don't translate caperberry. Well, the KJV and the NIV do not translate the word here as caperberry. They translate it as desire. Desire is ineffective. In other words, the old man's desires are gone for food and for sex. Where do they get that translation as opposed to the NASB, Holman Christian Study Bible, caperberry? Well, according to BibleStudyTools.com, quote, their repute as excitants of sexual desire is ancient and widespread. In other words, a caperberry is an aphrodisiac. Well, why is the caperberry ineffective? Well, the old man is so old that aphrodisiacs have no effect on him. Or it could be that the caperberry has lost its fluids and cannot do what a caperberry normally does, which is to stimulate sexual appetites. So it's either the caperberry's fault or it's the old man's fault. It could be both. Just ain't working anymore. They didn't have Viagra and Cialis back then. So Solomon continues with his pitiful description of an old man. He ends verse 5 by saying, for man goes to his eternal home while mourners go about in the street. Now, his eternal home could be in the grave, but we'll see here in just a minute that Solomon does believe in the afterlife. He believes that the spirit goes to be with God. So he dies and the mourners wander around in the street. We go now to Ecclesiastes 12, verses 6 through 8. Before the silver cord is snapped and the gold bowl is broken, and the jar is shattered at the spring, and the wheel is broken into the well, and the dust returns to the earth as it once was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Verse 6 actually picks up in the middle of a verse, at least as the Holman Christian Study Bible has translated it. For man goes to his eternal home in verse 5, while the mourners go about in the street before the silver cord is snapped. In other words, the mourners are getting ready before the silver cord is snapped. Now, this is an interesting metaphor, and of course the commentators split all over the place. Most of the commentators say it's the marrow or the matter in the spinal cord that runs from the base of the neck down to the waist. The nerves, the muscles, the tendons that are in the spinal cord, the color of which is white, it loosens after death, it's snapped when you die. Well, verse 6 doesn't say loosens, it says it's snapped. But loosely, that's one interpretation. Another interpretation is that the silver cord is the bond between soul and body. I've seen that one before. I don't know why that would be. Option number three is it's the tongue of a dying man. It binds and scourges like a cord. The tongue is compared to silver in Proverbs 10:20. The tongue of the righteous is as choice silver, and so this silver tongue is snapped. It doesn't talk anymore. I don't think so. I think it's the marrow in the backbone is the best option. Gill and Jameson, Fawcett and Brown agree. Now the golden bowl that's broken, two options there. It could be the skull of the dying man. It's shaped like a bowl and it's called golden because it is precious. It's broken because the old man dies. That's option one. Option two is the golden bowl is a gilded lamp of frail material. That golden bowl was often hung from roofs, that golden lamp. Was often hung from roofs by a cord of silk and silver interwoven. And of course, that would be option number four as to what the silver cord is, a literal silver cord that holds up a golden lamp. When the silver cord breaks, the lamp falls to the ground. Actually, because I don't like to get too far off into poetic metaphors, that makes more sense to me. A literal silver cord is snapped, the golden lamp smashes to the ground, and that is a metaphor of the old man dying. Next, in verse 6, the jar is shattered at the spring, and the wheel is broken into the well. Picture, if you will, a handmaiden going to the well with a jar. She uses the wheel of the well to wind the bucket down into the well. She smashes the jar by accident. As she goes to the well, the jar is smashed because the wheel breaks and drops the jar into the well. And so, all that she is doing to get water is futile, which matches verse 8. Absolute futility, says the teacher. Everything is futile. So the woman fails to get water from the well. That's a good symbol of the man failing to live anymore. Verse 7, and the dust returns to the earth as it once was. The dust, of course, referring to the old man's body, dust to dust, ashes to ashes. And the spirit returns to God who gave it. And that's how we know that Solomon is not a materialist. He believes in the afterlife. He says, the spirit of the old man is going to return to God. I do not believe that's metaphorical. I believe that's literal. God gave the spirit, and he's going to get it back. Well, Solomon finishes that exalted thought with verse 8, absolute futility. Well, he's referring to life under the sun, as I've said many times. He's not talking about the afterlife. He's talking about everything on this earth is absolute futility. He's not saying that the spirit returning to God is futility, because that's not futility. That's not meaningless. All of these metaphors are a resumption of the sentiment with which the book began. Ecclesiastes 1 verse 2, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. In the New Testament, the Apostle John says something very similar in 1 John 2:17. The world is passing away and also its lust, but the one who does the will of God lives forever. We now move to the conclusion of chapter 12 and the conclusion of the book of Ecclesiastes. Solomon is now finished talking about how bad it is to be old and to die, and he finishes up with saying some nice things about himself. Ecclesiastes 9-11, in addition to the teacher being a wise man, he constantly taught the people knowledge. He weighed, explored, and arranged many proverbs. The teacher sought to find delightful sayings and write words of truth accurately. The sayings of the wise are like goads, and those from masters of collections are like firmly embedded nails. The sayings are given by one shepherd. The teacher, of course, is Solomon. The NASB has preacher. Holman Christian Study Bible has teacher. I like teacher better. Preacher is ambiguous. In the New Testament, preaching can refer to evangelism or it can refer to teaching. So the word is ambiguous. Koaleth is how sometimes, that's the Hebrew, sometimes you see that. In addition to Solomon being a wise man, he constantly taught the people knowledge. He weighed, explored, and arranged. He didn't just search for knowledge himself. He taught other people his knowledge. He arranged many proverbs. 1 Kings 4:32 says, he also spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. That's a lot of proverbs, and that's a lot of songwriting. Verse 10, the teacher sought to find delightful sayings and write words of truth accurately. He collected proverbs as well as wrote them. Verse 11, the sayings of the wise are like goads. A goad is a prong, a rod, by which you poke the ox walking down the road. You poke him in his legs to make him stay on the road or to make him move. Proverbs do the same thing. They prick us. They poke us. They help us stay on the road. and sayings from masters of collections. A master of a collection is somebody like Solomon who collects proverbs. They're like firmly embedded nails. As Adam Clark says, every proverb sinking deeply into the mind is like a nail which sinks into the wood and is firmly embedded. The proverb, in other words, is hard to forget. The sayings are given by one shepherd. A shepherd is somebody who looks after his people. Solomon is looking after his people with all of his wisdom. We move now to Ecclesiastes 12, verses 12 through 14, and we will finish both this chapter and the entire book of Ecclesiastes. Solomon continues, "But beyond this, my son, be warned. The writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body. The conclusion, when all has been heard, is, fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil." Now, when Solomon says in verse 12, "my son," he could have had his son Rehoboam, especially in mind, as John Gill says. And of course, Rehoboam turned out to not have a lot of wisdom. He split the kingdom in the north and the south because he refused to be easy on the northern 10 tribes in the matter of taxation. It could be that Solomon is just referring to anybody who reads the book and he affectionately calls them my son. He says, be warned about something. The writing of many books is endless. Now that's ironic for somebody who wrote 3,000 proverbs and had written 1,005 songs. And this is interesting because this is in the time of the ancient Near East, in the 10th century B.C. If there were many books back then, and if the production of books back then was endless, think about how it is now. If you will look into a library, the number of books is astounding. Nobody ever reads them. It's impossible to read all the books that there are in the world. I myself put one book out there. Nobody ever reads it. Excessive devotion to books is wearing to the body, Solomon says. That is like a nail firmly embedded in wood in my mind because I have been devoted to books all my life and it is wearisome. I've got books all over my mobile phone. I've got them all over my study, all over my bedrooms. Why is all this wearying? Well, this is what John Gill says. A man may lay out his money and fill his library with books and be very little the better for them. What one writer affirms, another denies. What one seems to have proved clearly, another rises up and points out his errors and mistakes. And this occasions replies and rejoinders, so that there is no end of these things, and scarce any profit by them, which, without so much trouble, may be found in the writings of wise men inspired by God, and in which we should rest contented. I had to come to this myself. Study the Bible, folks. I've read philosophy, and oh, you think that people in general disagree. Philosophers spend their whole lives trashing what earlier philosophers have said. Nobody agrees. I listened to a whole history of philosophy podcast, and I thought, please, when are you ever going to come to the truth? Always teaching and studying, but never coming to the knowledge of the truth, because the natural mind has not been illumined by the Holy Spirit. Even if you just focus on the Bible, you still got problems, because people write a million books about the Bible, and sometimes they disagree on theology, but at least the focus is narrower. At least you have a common set of beliefs that you can hold on to, which keeps the speculation from running too far afield. Solomon here is just restating his main thesis. You cannot find wisdom out there in the world. And this is the wisest man of the ancient Near East. And he finally says, nope, you can read all the books you want. You're not going to find wisdom. So what's the bottom line here? He says, fear God. That's what it all boils down to. Fear, reverence God. Keep his commandments, because he's going to judge you one day. Everything that's hidden, whether evil or good, is going to come out. Well, if that was true back then, it sure is more true today. You're not going to find wisdom in all these books that are out there. Here's what Adam Clark says. How true is this? Let the trembling knees, the palsied hands, the darkened eyes, the aching heart, and the puzzled mind of every real student declare. And should none more worthy of the name of student be within reach to consult, the writer of this work is a proof in point. Now, Adam Clark, he knows everything. He's second only to God in the amount of knowledge that somebody has. He is a true polymath. And he says, hey, I can't find it all. I can't find true wisdom. He says, the writer of this work is a proof in point. He's talking about himself. And he describes himself as having trembling knees, palsied hands, darkened eyes, an aching heart, and a puzzled mind. Now in verse 14, when Solomon says, God will bring every act to judgment. This is referring to the last judgment. Probably it could be. So that means some secret sins and evil things don't get brought to light until then, but they will be brought to light. And so the final judgment is the final arbiter as to what is wise and what is vanity. You're not going to find it by reading books of philosophy. Fear God and let Him tell you what's true. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the light. You want to find truth? Quit reading all the books of philosophy. Listen to what Jesus said, and He will reveal truth unto you. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with chapter 12, and we are finished with the book of Ecclesiastes. We're going to continue with Solomon, though, in our next audio as we look at his love poetry, the Song of Solomon. I hope to see you in that next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.